Good afternoon, brethren. Hope everybody had a good week. The last time I spoke, I had gone over a comparison of the building of the tabernacle, the building of the temple, and the building of the church. And while I was preparing that message, I was intrigued that God seemed to care so much about how the tabernacle was set up. He spent a very large section of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, for a very detailed description of exactly how the tabernacle was set up. Let's turn over to Exodus 25 and read verses 8 and 9. This is God speaking. He says, "And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them according to all that I show you, that is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, just so you shall make it." You know, I think at that time I described that, you know, God was the designer of the tabernacle, and he had a very, very specific pattern in mind that he wanted used. Today, I want to look at that pattern as it's described in the Bible and see if we can learn something from it, because I don't think that he spent so much time on something that we can't learn anything from. And a first item of interest sort of was mentioned in the first two verses that we read, but it's where the tabernacle was located. Let's turn over to Numbers chapter 2. Numbers chapter 2, and we're going to read verses 1 and 2. Numbers 2, verses 1 and 2. And it says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, every one of the camp of the children of Israel shall camp by his own standard beside the emblems of his father's house. They shall camp some distance from the tabernacle of meeting." Now, first, the tent of meeting or tabernacle of meeting is the tabernacle. And God specified that as Israel camped, that they were to camp around the tabernacle. And each tribe was to be facing it. I think I had the wrong scripture there. Oh, wait. Here we go. I should have kept reading. In verse 3, "On the east side, toward the rising of the sun, those of the standard of the forces with Judah shall camp according to their armies." And he goes through a whole description. And then he says, "On the south side shall be," on verse 10, "shall be those of the standard of Reuben." Goes through their whole thing. And then there was a standard of Dan on the north side in verse 25, and Manasseh, I believe, was on the west side. So they basically camped around the tabernacle. There were three tribes camped on each side of the tabernacle. Now, if we keep in mind that God dwelt in the tabernacle, we can see that God wanted to literally, in this case, be in the midst of his people. Now, as an overview of the complex itself, the tabernacle wasn't just one building per se. It was a complex. It was made up of several different parts. There was the outer court. Then there was the tabernacle itself, located in the western half of the outer court. And the tabernacle was broken up into two chambers. The first chamber was called the holy place, and it was separated by a veil from the second chamber that was called the holy of holies. Let's turn to Exodus 27. Read verses 9 through 19. Exodus 27, starting in verse 9. It's going to describe the court of the tabernacle. "You shall make the court of the tabernacle. For the south side there shall be hangings for the court woven of fine linen thread, 100 cubits long for one side. And its 20 pillars and their 20 sockets shall be of bronze. The hooks of the pillars and their bands shall be of silver. Likewise, along the length of the north side, there shall be hangings 100 cubits long, and his 20 pillars and their 20 sockets of bronze, and the hooks of the pillars and their bands of silver. And along the width of the court, on the west side, shall be hangings of 50 cubits, with their 10 pillars and their 10 sockets. The width of the court on the east side shall be 50 cubits. The hangings on one side of the gate shall be 15 cubits, with their 3 pillars and 3 sockets. And on the other side shall be hangings 15 cubits with their 3 pillars and 3 sockets. For the gate of the court there shall be a screen, 20 cubits long, woven of blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen thread, made by a weaver. It shall have 4 pillars and 4 sockets. All the pillars around the court shall have bands of silver, Their hooks shall be of silver, and their sockets of bronze. The length of the court shall be 100 cubits, the width 50 throughout, and the height 5 cubits, woven of fine linen thread and sockets of bronze. And all the utensils of the tabernacle for all its services and all its pegs, and all the pegs of the court shall be bronze. Now, we read here that if you were approaching the tabernacle complex, you would see a wall of white linen. When they say fine linen, they mean white. So it would have been a fairly substantial wall of white linen on the south side, the west side, and the north side. The east side was a little bit different. And it really, cubits don't mean much to me, so maybe they don't mean much to you. It would have been 150 feet long by 75 feet wide, and it would have been 7.5 feet tall. So it wasn't a small wall that you could look over. It would have blocked the view of everything around it. But on the middle of the east side, there was a section of screen that was 30 feet long. And that section of screen was the gate. And the gate wasn't made with a door like we would think that swings out or open. It was instead fabric, and it was a screen that you would walk through. And the screen was blue, purple, scarlet, and white fabric. And if you walked through that, you would come into the courtyard. Now, the colors are significant. You know, most commentators suggested that, you know, the blue was representative of the law because of the fringes of the garments that God had talked about, saying that they should have a blue thread in there so that they could remember the commandments of God. There were others that suggested the blue might have represented the sky and God's eternal nature. Purple, everybody was pretty much in agreement with, was a color associated with royalty. Scarlet was a color associated with sacrifice. And white was purity. So that wall of white would have been a call to all the people that this was a pure place. This was a courtyard within which everything was supposed to be pure. So additionally, because the entrance was a screen, there was no bar to prevent anyone from entering. And therefore, it was always open. It was, however, the only way to enter with your sacrifice and seek atonement with God. But it did require a personal decision to enter through the screen. Now, I want to go back and read Numbers chapter 2 and verse 3 again. There was one point there in verse 3. It says, on the east side, toward the rising of the sun, those of the standard of the forces of Judah shall camp according to their armies. Now, there's a couple interesting things about that. First of all, as we mentioned before, the east side was the location of the entrance. So the standard of Judah would have been at the entrance to the tabernacle. And it also points out that it was the east side was the side that the sun was going to be rising up on every day. So they would have been facing the outer court, and specifically mentions direction of the sun side, and I don't think that's an accident. You know, the gate was facing, or the entrance was facing, the first light of day. Let's turn back to John chapter 10. John chapter 10, we're going to read verses 7 and 9. It says, then Jesus said to them again, most assuredly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. Now, Jesus, the true king of the house of Judah, the bringer of light into a dark world, states that he is the door for all of his sheep. I definitely think that the gate to the outer court, and actually, if you look throughout, the gate of the outer court is designed exactly like the gate to the tabernacle itself, and with the same or a very similar pattern to the veil within the tabernacle. He is the door, he says. The gate to the tabernacle was a symbol of Jesus Christ. He also is a gate that is always open to his sheep. You know, one other point I want to make here about the outer court is that we are specifically told that there are two metals that were used in its construction. We're going to see that God used different metals to represent different concepts. And the metal most associated with the outer courtyard was bronze. You know, the bases of all the pillars were all bronze. The pegs holding the tension lines that basically kept the walls up were all made of bronze. And all the utensils within the court would have been made with bronze. You know, bronze, from everything that I read, is generally considered to be representative of judgment. A lot of the commentators referred to the example of the bronze serpent that was lifted up at God's command when Israel sinned and had sent snakes among the people as punishment. The other metal used in the courtyard was silver. And in the courtyard, the silver was used as ornaments on top of the pillar, and it was also used as hooks, basically keeping that white fabric together so that it was all knit together nicely. Silver is generally considered to be representative of redemption. This is because the silver shekel was also used to pay the atonement money that God had required Israel to pay. You know, silver was also used to buy both Joseph and later Jesus Christ. You know, but considering these symbols taken together for the outer wall, the white fabric representing purity was held together and decorated with silver, meaning redemption, and sat on a bronze base of judgment. This is the kind of purity and that God was looking for the people to enter into. Now, once you entered the outer court, there were three items that you would see in the courtyard. The first that you would see was the altar. Then behind that was the laver or basin. And then behind those sat the tabernacle itself. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 27. We're going to read a little bit about the altar. We'll read verses 1 through 7. And it says, "You shall make an altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits broad. The altar shall be square, and its height shall be 3 cubits. You shall make its horns on its 4 corners. Its horns shall be of 1 piece with it, and you shall overlay it with bronze. Also, you shall make its pans to receive its ashes, and its shovels, and its basins, and its forks, and its fire pans. You shall make all of its utensils of bronze. You shall make a grate for it, a network of bronze. And on the network you shall make 4 bronze rings at its 4 corners. You shall put it under the rim of the altar beneath that the network may be midway up the altar. And you shall make poles for the altar, poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with bronze. The poles shall be put into the rings, and the poles shall be on the 2 sides of the altar to bear it." Now the altar, the dimensions, if you put it into our measurements, was 7.5 feet wide and long and 4.5 feet tall. And it was made like of acacia wood, which was a very hard wood, and everything was overlaid with bronze. And the altar was used to make sacrifices. That was its main purpose. Let's turn over to Leviticus chapter 17. Leviticus chapter 17. We'll start in verse 5. Read verse 5 and 6. It says, "To the end that the children of Israel may bring their sacrifices which they offer in the open field, that they may bring them to the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting to the priest and offer them as peace offerings to the Lord. And the priest shall sprinkle the blood on the altar of the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting and burn the fat for a sweet aroma to the Lord." Let's drop down to verse 11. It says, "For the life of the flesh is in the blood. I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul." So the sacrifice involved the slitting of the throat of the sacrificial animal so that the blood could be used to atone for the sin. And portions or all of the animal, depending on the type of sacrifice, would also be burned by fire. Now, this was all necessary because God cannot be approached by sinful men. Atonement had to be made first. Now, certainly the altar was a foreshadowing of the sacrifice that Jesus would make once for all. Because only Jesus' blood can really completely remove sin. And we know this. If we turn back to Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 13 and 14. It says, "For if the blood of bulls and goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies for the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" You know, Jesus Christ was the ultimate sacrifice. His blood is necessary for us to be able to approach God. Just like this altar was a symbol to Israel that sacrifice, and blood specifically, was required to atone for their sins. Now, after the altar, I said, there was the laver, or the basin. Let's read about that. If we go to Exodus chapter 30, we're going to read verses 17 through 21. It says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'You shall also make a laver of bronze, with its base also of bronze, for washing. You shall put it between the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, and you shall put water in it. For Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet in water from it, when they go into the tabernacle of meeting or when they come near to the altar to minister, to burn an offering made by fire to the Lord. They shall wash with water, lest they die. So they shall wash their hands and their feet, lest they die. And it shall be a statute forever to them, to him and his descendants throughout their generations.'" Now, after the altar, if you were not a priest, you'd never get any further in Israel. Now, we all know that we've been called to something even better, so this would apply to us as well. But after the altar, you would approach the laver or the basin, which was constructed completely of bronze this time. Now, the bronze basin held the water for washing, and only the priests were allowed to wash in this bronze basin. And they had to wash their hands and their feet. Their hands were representative of what they did, you know, their work. Their feet were representative of where they went and how they lived. To approach God, both had to be clean, because they had to do this before they could enter the tabernacle. Let's turn over to Ezekiel 36. Ezekiel 36. And verse 25. We'll read down through 27. It says, "Then I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean. I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and from all your idols. I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will keep my judgments and do them." Let's also turn back to Hebrews 10, verse 22. Hebrews 10 and verse 22, it says, "Then let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water." And finally, let's turn back to John chapter 4. We're going to read verses 13 and 14. John chapter 4. Verse 13 through 14. And this is Jesus specifically. He says, "Jesus answered and said to her, Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life. So as the altar was a representative of Jesus' death, the basin was representative of the life that we get living in us through his Holy Spirit. So again, we need that in order to approach further to the next step, the actual tabernacle. So after the altar, representing the sacrifice for sin, and then the laver, or the basin, representing the life of Jesus within us, then you would finally reach the tabernacle. Let's read a little bit about the tabernacle. We'll go back to Exodus 26. We'll read verses 15 through 30. And for the tabernacle you shall make the boards of acacia wood, standing upright. 10 cubits shall be the length of a board, and 1.5 cubits shall be the width of each board. 2 tenons shall be in each board for the binding, one to another. Thus you shall make for all the boards of the tabernacle, and you shall make the boards for the tabernacle 20 boards for the south side, and you shall make 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards, 2 sockets under one board for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under another board for its 2 tenons. And for the second side of the tabernacle, the north side, there shall be 20 boards, and there 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one board and 2 sockets under another board. For the far side of the tabernacle, westward, you shall make 6 boards, and you shall also make 2 boards for the 2 back corners of the tabernacle, and they shall be coupled together at the bottom, and they shall be coupled together at the top by 1 ring. Thus it shall be for both of them. They shall be for the 2 corners. So there shall be 8 boards with their sockets of silver, 16 sockets, 2 sockets under one board and 2 sockets under another board. And you shall make the bars of acacia wood, 5 for the boards on one side of the tabernacle, 5 bars for the boards on the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards of the tabernacle on the west side. The middle bar shall pass through the midst of the boards from end to end, and you shall overlay the boards with gold. Make their rings of gold as holders for the bars, and overlay the bars with gold. And you shall raise up the tabernacle according to its pattern, which you were shown on the mountain. Now, the tabernacle was 45 feet by 15 feet and was 15 feet tall. And it was constructed of a frame of acacia wood and gold. And they used a lot of gold in here. It was thousands of pounds of gold were used in the construction of this. And the frame sat on bases of silver, except at the entrance to the tabernacle, where the bases were made of bronze. And a screen of blue, purple, scarlet, and white was put up at the entrance, just like the entrance to the outer court. And from all the commentaries that I've read, they believe that the wood was representative of physicalness, you know, being of this world, something firm that could be understood. However, gold, which is only used in the tabernacle itself, was considered to be representative of God, of the deity. So we see the frame of this structure is made up of both materials. We'll see that most of the furnishings inside the tabernacle are also made up of both wood and gold as well. And again, this is very representative of what God planned to do with Jesus. He was both God and man. He came as both. Wasn't pure wood or gold. Used both. Let's read verses 31 through 33. And you shall make a veil woven of blue, purple, and scarlet yarn and a fine linen thread, and it shall be woven with artistic design of cherubim. And you shall hang it upon the 4 pillars of acacia wood overlain with gold. Their hooks shall be of gold upon 4 sockets of silver. And you shall hang the veil from the clasp. Then you shall bring the ark of the testimony in there behind the veil. The veil shall be a divider for you between the holy place and the most holy place. So further inside the tabernacle is divided into 2 separate rooms. The first room you'd see if you entered was called the holy place. And the second and smaller room in the back was called the most holy place. Now, only priests were allowed in the tabernacle at all, and most of them were only allowed into the holy place. However, once a year, the high priest was permitted to enter the most holy place. And that was all that he was ever allowed to do. Let's also read something interesting about the curtains here in verse 1 of chapter 26. It says, "Moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains woven of fine linen thread and blue and purple and scarlet yarn with artistic designs of cherubim. You shall weave them." And those curtains, again, the same colors that were used for the gate on the outer court and for the entrance to the tabernacle and the veil itself, were also used all around the tabernacle. But this time they had the pattern of a cherubim set within the curtains, which was a type of angel. So from the inside of the structure, it would have looked like the walls were entirely made of gold because of the boards overlaid with gold. And the curtains were on the outside. So taken together, we can kind of see that this whole tabernacle seems to be symbolic of Jesus Christ as well. Let's turn back to Hebrews chapter 9. It tells us some more interesting things. We're going to read in verse 2. Start in verse 2, it says. For a tabernacle was prepared, the first part, in which was the lampstand, the table, and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary, or holy place. And behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant overlaid with all sides, in which were the golden pot, and had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of all these things, we cannot now speak in detail. So he was stopping what he was saying there. But the holy space was 15 feet wide by 30 feet long by 15 feet high. And it had three pieces of furniture in it, like we just read there. If we read in chapter 26, verse 35 of Exodus, it tells us, "You shall set the table outside the veil, and the lampstand across the table on the side of the tabernacle toward the south side, and you shall put the table on the north side." So two of these pieces of furniture specifically mentioned here are the table and the lampstand. If we turn back to chapter Exodus 25 and go to verse 23, we're going to read about the table of the showbread. It says, "You shall also make a table of acacia wood. 2 cubits shall be its length, a cubit its width, and a cubit and a half its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold, and make a molding of gold all around. You shall make for it a frame of a handbreadth all around, and you shall make a gold molding for the frame all around." Let's drop down to verse 29. "You shall make its dishes, its pans, its pitchers, and its bowls for pouring. You shall make them of pure gold, and you shall set the showbread on the table before me always." So the table was 3 feet long by 1.5 feet wide and 2.5 feet high, and it was made again of acacia wood overlaid with pure gold. Now this was placed on the north side of the holy place, which means that if you would have been entering, it would have been on your right as you entered the holy place. And on it, showbread was placed, and they would replace this showbread every week. And they think that they stacked it 6 pieces on one side and 6 pieces on another side, and they had frankincense in there as well. Now, sometimes this table was referred to as the table of presence as well. But with the bread, I think we can see an obvious correlation to Jesus once again. If we turn back to John chapter 6, verse 35, "Then Jesus said to them, 'I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst.'" Again, this table and the bread represented Jesus, and specifically it represented him as our provider. Now the lampstand we would probably know this better as a menorah, was on the south side. We'll read a little bit about that in Exodus chapter 25, and we'll start in verse 31. And you shall make a lampstand of pure gold. The lampstand shall be of hammered work. Its shaft, its branches, its bowls, its ornamental knobs and flowers shall be of one piece. And six branches shall come out of its sides. Three branches of the lampstand shall go out on one side, and three branches of the lampstand out the other side. Three bowls shall be made like almond blossoms on one branch with an ornamental knob and a flower, and three bowls made like an almond blossom on the other branch with an ornamental knob and flower. And so for the six branches that come out of the lampstand. On the lampstand itself, four bowls shall be made like almond blossoms, each with its ornamental knob and flower. And there shall be a knob under the first two branches of the same, a knob under the second two branches of the same, and a knob under the third two branches of the same, according to the six branches extending from the lampstand. Their knobs and their branches shall be of one piece. All of it shall be one hammered piece of pure gold. You shall make seven lamps for it, and they shall arrange its lamps so that they give light in front of it. And its wick trimmers and their trays shall be of pure gold. It shall be made of a talent of pure gold with all these utensils. And see to it that you make them according to the pattern which was shown to you on the mountain. Now the lampstand or menorah was placed on the south side of the holy place. It would have been on your left as you entered the room. And it was constructed in the form of a tree. It had a base, it had a main trunk, and it had branches. And it was even decorated with almond blossoms. Now this is a piece of furniture that was made of pure gold. There was no wood used for the making of this. And this would have been the only source of light within the tabernacle, because the curtains basically blocked all the other light off. Now, if you imagine, the inside of this thing is made of pure gold, so it isn't going to take a huge amount of light to light up the whole room, because the candles, the seven lights, are going to be shining and reflecting off of all that gold. Let's turn over to John chapter 9. I'm going to read verse 5. And this is Jesus speaking. And he says, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. We know that Jesus made that claim. He also was prophesied in Isaiah as being a light bringer. Being a branch and a light bringer, actually. If we turn back to Isaiah, real quickly, there are a lot of verses where Jesus is referred to as a light bringer. I don't think I really have to convince you of that, but he's also mentioned as a branch many times. Let's turn over to Isaiah 4 and verse 2. It specifically says here, in that day, the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and appealing for those of Israel who have escaped. And this is talking of the renewal at the end time. You know, this lampstand was a reminder that God is the only source of light. And Jesus is also identified as a branch of the Lord, similar to the branches on the lampstand here. Again, I think we're seeing that, you know, most of this furniture, most of this tabernacle was all pointing to Jesus and to God, which was exactly its purpose. Let's turn back to Exodus 30 again. We're going to read about the altar of incense. It says, you shall make an altar to burn incense on. You shall make it of acacia wood. A cubit shall be its length and a cubit its width. It shall be square and two cubits shall be its height. Its horns shall be of one piece with it, and you shall overlay its top, its sides, all around, and its horns with pure gold. And you shall make for it a molding of gold all around. Two gold rings you shall make for it under the molding on the both sides, and you shall place them on its two sides, and they will be holders for the poles with which to bear it. And you shall make the poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. And you shall put it before the veil, that is, before the Ark of the Testimony, before the mercy seat that is over the testimony where I will meet with you. And Aaron shall burn on it sweet incense every morning when he tends the lamp, and shall burn incense on it. And when Aaron lights the lamps at twilight, he shall burn incense on it, a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generations. You shall not offer strange incense on it, or a burnt offering or a meal offering, nor shall you pour a drink offering on it. And Aaron shall make atonement upon its horns once a year with the blood of the sin offering of atonement. Once a year he shall make atonement upon it throughout your generations. It is most holy to the Lord. So the third item that you would have seen in this holy place as you entered was the golden altar. And as you entered, it would have been right in front of you, but in the back of the room, right in front of the veil. Now this was 1.5 feet wide by 1.5 feet long and 3 feet tall. And this was also made of wood, and it was overlaid completely with gold. Incense was burned on this daily, but on the Day of Atonement, the high priest was supposed to make atonement on the horns of the golden altar with the blood of the sin offering. And remember, this sat right in front of the veil to the Holy of Holies. Let's turn back to Revelation chapter 8. It makes an interesting statement, or I think we'll see something interesting at least. Revelation chapter 8, and we're going to read in verse 3. It says, "Then another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar. And he was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hand." So this the incense is representative of an actual golden altar that apparently exists in heaven. And the incense was representative of prayers. Now this time, I believe this also represents Jesus as the wood and gold put together. But this time, it's specifying his role as the intercessor for us. We're told that he is our high priest. He's the one that allows us to go directly to the Father. And at his death, the veil itself was cut in two, making access to the Holy of Holies in the temple. And the incense being our prayers, he offers before the Father as a sweet aroma. Now we've finally gotten to the veil. We're going to go through the veil and we get to the Holy of Holies. This is a small room at the back of the tabernacle, divided from the holy place by the veil. The room was a perfect 15-foot by 15-foot by 15-foot cube. And in it was the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat, which sat on the ark. We turn back to Exodus 25. I'm going to read verses 10 through 16. It says, "And they shall make an ark of acacia wood. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold. Inside and out you shall overlay it, and shall make on it a molding of gold all around. You shall cast 4 rings of gold for it and put them in its 4 corners. 2 rings shall be on one side and 2 rings on the other side. And you shall make poles of acacia wood and overlay them with gold. You shall put poles into the rings on the sides of the ark that the ark may be carried by them. The poles shall be in the rings of the ark and they shall not be taken from it. And you shall put into the ark the testimony which I will give you." Now the ark, again, was acacia wood overlaid by gold, and it was 3.5 feet long by 2.25 feet wide and 2.25 feet high. Now, we know from other scriptures that there were 3 items that they actually put into the ark. The tablets with the 10 commandments, a golden pot of manna, and Aaron's rod that had budded. They were all put into the ark. And I believe that each of these have symbolic meaning, but as I think I'm running out of time, I'm not going to go into them today. Perhaps somebody else will do that later. But again, the ark seems to be symbolic of Jesus, specifically as leader and authority of Israel, as God. There's one final thing that was on the ark. Some people would consider this part of the ark, but the Bible kind of describes it as a separate item. We're going to read verse 17 through 22 of chapter 25. It says, "And you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its width. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold, of hammered work. You shall make them at the 2 ends of the mercy seat. Make 1 cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. And you shall make the cherubim at the 2 ends of it of one piece with the mercy seat. And the cherubim shall be stretching out their wings above, covering the mercy seat with their wings. And they shall face one another, and the faces of the cherubim shall be towards the mercy seat. You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark. And in the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. And there I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim which are on the ark of the testimony, of all the things which I will give you in command to the children of Israel." So the final piece of furniture was placed on top of the ark, and it was a solid gold covering that God referred to as a mercy seat. It's interesting that it's referred to as a mercy seat. It had 2 cherubim on either side with wings spread over it, and it was symbolic of God's throne. That his throne would be a throne of mercy is very comforting for us, and we know that our God is a merciful God, but he states, or he put that into the very plan of the ark that he was making there. And he mentions that he himself would meet and speak with Moses, at least, from above that mercy seat. Now, Moses would have been on the other side of the veil, but he would have heard God through there. When he went into, the Bible talks a lot, if you read throughout Exodus, he goes into the tabernacle a lot, and God seems to speak with him. And God apparently was speaking from above the mercy seat through the veil. Now, there's probably a lot more to the pattern that I haven't picked up on. There's a lot of scriptures that we did not read on the actual construction. Other things that they did as well. They had a tent over top of the tabernacle that I didn't get into. But I felt like these were a lot of the really important things that he had gone over. And we've looked at the pattern, and I think we can see that much of this pictures Jesus and the various roles that he plays for mankind. It was almost a prophetic foreshadowing of a lot of the things that he was planning on doing. This truly was a structure meant to picture God in so many different ways. And hopefully, by looking at the pattern, we also can learn a little bit more about the God that we worship.